to the present moment, it's our distinct pleasure to have with us this morning a 1980 graduate of Concordia Seminary who was in all of our hearts and prayers certainly last June when the Boeing 727 flight 847, those numbers just became engraved in our minds, in which he was serving as flight engineer, was hijacked in Athens and by Shiite Muslims and forced to fly to Beirut, Lebanon. That story belongs to Chris Zimmerman, and I would not presume to relate even a bit of it. Some of you may not be aware, however, that such circumstances aren't entirely unique in Chris's family. His father, the now sainted Reverend Elmer Zimmerman, was a missionary in China and was captured by the Japanese in the 40s, and after his release, he served here for some years, I think from 42 to 1955, as a professor of missions here at Concordia. In fact, it was Chris's intention to be with his father here in St. Louis for his nephew Keith Ellerbrock's ordination last June, when on the 14th that plan was rudely interrupted. It was during Chris's own imprisonment in Beirut that his father ordained Keith from his hospital bed in St. Louis shortly before being called to glory by the Lord of the church. And surely with Isaiah we assent, his ways are not our ways, his thoughts not our ways, but we do know the thoughts that he thinks toward us, thoughts of good and not of evil. And we know that he can turn the seemingly darkest of circumstances into opportunities to witness to his saving truth and works, even in, or perhaps especially in, the most unlikely times and unlikely places. As I said, that's the story that belongs to Reverend Benjamin Christian Zimmerman, whom we are pleased to have with us this morning. Help me welcome him, please, Chris.
Curious. I wonder what you're clapping for. I guess I'm not used to this sort of thing. You'd think I would be after a period of time. I've gotten to where I'm not nervous in front of a press corps. I'm really not nervous in front of a group of people. Just to give you some personal insights, I do get nervous when it comes to preaching. Somehow, I think it's because we've been taught that there's a special way that you're supposed to preach or some type of image that you're supposed to live up to, and I never quite know whether or not I'm fulfilling that image or not. In a way, I'd like to talk about the hijacking and hostage situation, but rather than do that, since you've all read so many of the different accounts, I don't know what you've read and what you need filled in on, and rather than just repeat a lot of war stories, I think I'll leave that open to the question and answer period that I would like to have following this, and I will answer your questions on just about anything. One of the curious developments in this is that from a governmental standpoint, we've established our own security identification process. We classify our own material, so if I don't answer the question or if I beat around the bush, then you know what I'm doing. Instead, I'd rather address missions and how that equals evangelism, because that's something that's kind of been in the family for a long time, and that's what I have always been most interested in, and that's what I would like to address. I also think it's important to point out that I will be speaking of Christians. And when I do so, I'll be talking about both lay people and clergy. I find that when we go out into the world, it's my observation that it is important to be a Christian and not to identify as either clergy or layperson. I think we are all individual Christians as we work in our lives. The different things that the Lord puts in our paths could either be professional from the ministry standpoint, or they could be professional in any other occupation. As Martin Luther would say, we all have callings in life. And they're not neatly defined in neat little boxes like we would like to put them so that we could feel comfortable with them. So a Christian is a Christian, regardless of what his calling in life might be. I think there's also a problem in regard to the approach to our church today, and I think we could talk probably most authoritatively on the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. There's this historical tendency to drift into some form of clerical arrogance, and I would urge you to be aware of this tendency as students and professors and pastors alike, that this can certainly happen. It's a subconscious thing. Nobody intends to do it deliberately, and yet it does occur, and it is perceived. And perhaps if there's a rub against, if there are ill feelings toward the professional church by people that we would have come to Christianity or know more about Christianity, that resistance comes as a result of an observed clerical arrogance. And I think we have to always be aware that that can happen. I think also we need to not only be aware of in ourselves, but that other people go through the same thing. Fear. We all deal with different forms of fear, whether it be professional fear, whether it be just fear in our social status, in our community, in our family, in our economic management, or what have you. We all are bothered by different forms of fear. And perhaps it is this fear within the professional clergy that causes us to put this shell around us, which is then observed as this clerical arrogance that I mentioned. So I think rather than try and shell ourselves from fear, it's kind of important that we recognize that we do have fears and that they do need to be dealt with. There's different kinds for different Christians, and about the only way to sidestep these fears or to deal with them, not sidestep them, I guess is better, is to be prepared. And as Christians, again, the only way that we can be prepared is to, one, know the gospel. Not memorize, but know what was going on when Jesus came and lived on this earth for a while. Know what that is all about and what was going on. And that means putting it in your own words many times. And you do that every time you preach, but nevertheless, it should be something that is taught to the parishioners so that they can do that in their everyday life. And I know this is just standard evangelism, but it's the same thing that works in missions. It's the development that took place in China. Perhaps there's a relationship with the Three Self movement that goes on in China these days, in that it is important that the indigenous take care of their own ministry with their own people. And the only way to penetrate any cultural barrier is to know your stuff when you're talking about what was going on concerning who Jesus was, where he came from, and what he did. That's the gospel, and that's what you have to know. And a lot of memorized passages, I think, just go over a lot of people's heads because they can tell when you're dealing with memorized passages. Not to say that it's not good to have memorized passages. Don't read something into what I'm saying. But I do believe that you have to be able to explain things in your own words. I think also a sense of history is important. If there's a weakness amongst many of our Christian brethren across America, very often they run off half-prepared in many directions. They know the gospel, but they don't know history. They don't know where the church has come from. They don't know what has happened in years past, many years past, the development of the church. The development of the church amidst a world that had many other religions developing at the same time. And the relationship and the interrelationship between Christianity and the pre-established other religious cultures and things like Islamic religions that developed concurrently with Christianity. I think knowledge of history is probably one of the best ways to prepare for mission work / evangelism in the church today, and therefore I'll give a plug for the historical department here. I think it's also particularly important to develop a curiosity are to teach your people to have a curiosity concerning the people that they work with and associate with, so that when suddenly either you find yourself in an unusual situation, not only are you prepared with knowing what the gospel is all about, but you are prepared in a few other ways. And one of them is to be curious. To a limited degree, granted, because there must be an ulterior motive to being curious, and that is to look for openers, look for opportunities. And obviously you can see that this works in an Islamic setting as well as it does in a factory or wherever your people might interact with wherever the Lord has put them in their life, whatever their calling is. You have to be able to interact, and you can't do it from the standpoint of I know it all and they should learn from me. That just isn't how human nature works. Human nature says that people want to be heard and everybody needs to express themselves. And so let them express themselves. Ask them questions about where they're from. Find out what they believe. And you can't approach them from the standpoint of knowing what they believe. You might have some good ideas, but it was my discovery that I really did not have as good a handle on what was important to Muslims as what I thought was important to them. I really didn't understand their priorities. We're taught technical detail concerning what a particular religion believes and what is important to them. But in this case in Lebanon, it was my observation, and you should know that one of my military duties is that of being an intelligence officer. So I felt sort of keyed into making these observations as to what was going on. It was my observation that with the different factions of Shia Muslims, they don't refer to themselves as Shiite, by the way, they are either Shia Muslims or Shahat. These Shia Muslims were of different cuts. And in our case, as we spent 2 weeks in the big red and white camper out there on the tarmac in Beirut, we had two factions of Muslims guarding each other as well as guarding us, the Hezbollah and the Amal movement people. Amal movement people were not a military unit per se, and yet they were. Hezbollah were not a military unit per se, and yet they were. On the other hand, many of them were members of the Army of Lebanon, which was a military unit. And these were sort of like being in the National Guard and on active duty at the same time. This is how it was with them. And many of them lived out there because their families were gone or they were out of homes. And as a result, they spent all of their free time with their buddies in the movements. There were many more Amal, and we learned to refer to them with terminology that we're familiar with out west. We referred to them as the Jack Muslims. And they were a lot more liberal, as Muslims go. They, on the other hand, were much better behaved on the airplane than we suspect they were off the airplane, because on the airplane they were also being watched by the Hezbollah. And Hezbollah were very particular in their religious legal observations. And these, as they watched each other, they minded their P's and Q's, so to speak, concerning what would leave the best impression of Shia Muslims to the world. So we would ask them what they believed, and they would tell us. And we got different answers from the two different groups, which was curious, because they're all Shia Muslims. And we'd say, well, they would begin with saying, we're a Shahat, and our leader is the Ayatollah in Iran. And we soon found out that their disinformation that they had been receiving for years and years had a great deal to do with the voice of Iran. So as we listened to the Hezbollah and then the Amal people, we learned to distinguish. It took us about 4 or 5 days to even realize that they were different groups of people. And then we learned to observe dress differences between them. For instance, Amal always wore some semblance of fatigues, and Hezbollah always wore some form of civilian clothes. The ones in the hoods that you saw, those were the pillowcases on the airplanes, and they would cut holes in them for their eyes. And they were all Hezbollah. They seemed to be more paranoid concerning the CIA than, and they thought the press was all CIA, and yet they wanted to have the press coverage. It was a curious, all these little games were going on. But when we found out from them what they believed, then you had a good starting point with that particular individual, because they would start off with two or three gathered together talking to you, and there would, it would filter out. One or two would leave, and you'd end up with one. And that happened over and over again, because the guards were changed every night at about between 9 and 10 o'clock in the evening. We got a new shift, a new set of four Amal movement people and a new set of two Hezbollah. And they didn't necessarily get along with each other. In fact, on the airplane, it was the first time that they had learned to talk to each other or trust each other to any extent. Prior to that, they don't really talk to each other. So this was a curious thing that we observed. So in finding out what they believed, we then could move on to the next step. I'm not sure what John Testrick, who was also a very committed Christian, was doing personally, but I guess when I say we, I'm talking about the particular discussions that I was able to lead in. We would then ask them what it was that they were taught that we believed as Christians. And that was curious. That started off accidentally, because they would just start off accusing us of believing this or that. And as time went on, we found that we actually deliberately approached it from that perspective. We would ask them, what do we believe as Christians? And they would tell us. Of course, it was usually all wet. But it was interesting to hear what, in fact, they had been taught. And, boy, talk about an opener. First of all, we had to keep them brief while they were talking about what they believed. We wanted to know just the high-priority items. And then, in the process, it was very easy to ask them about what Christians believe, and they just would transition right into that. And I think that works in any evangelistic setting. Exactly the same procedure. That's why I see such an intermesh between missions and evangelism. As they then would tell us what Christians believed, that gave us a very distinct and authoritative and respected position from which to launch off with a gospel presentation as we corrected what it was that they thought we believed. We could teach them very specifically a few things, and one of them would be the area of what pleases God and what displeases God. From their perspective, they thought that Christians were just like Muslims, in that if they don't create an Islamic state all over the world, then militarily that's exactly what Christians intended to do. Therefore, they were defending themselves against this Christian military adventurism, you might say. And we found it quite simple, with Bibles in hand, to say, that's not quite accurate, because the very specific teachings of Jesus divide the kingdoms, and in fact, he speaks very definitely against this sort of thing. And they were curious. They'd never heard this before from anybody. For one thing, in previous years, when they had better relations with Americans, they had learned to love Americans, and they really enjoyed the American people. They couldn't understand why the American people hated Muslims so. And they were very friendly toward Americans, but they couldn't understand this hatred. Then we would discuss things with them in a way that perhaps had never happened before, because in years past, their relationship was a commercial relationship. Tourists doing business with Muslims in shops, that type of thing. And you never get into personal ideological or religious discussions or political discussions with people when you're a tourist and they're running a shop. Even a little more interesting discussions that might have developed never went as far as these discussions generally, because here we were eating with these people, sleeping with these people, spending a lot of time with these people, and they had nobody to talk to but us, and we had no one to talk to but them. And it worked out into very profitable conversations. I think working people who are over there, though, have opportunities. People who are in industry and whose employment leads them into some Arabic country where they are continually rubbing shoulders with contemporaries who happen to be Islamic. So the opportunities are there. In this case, we were afraid. Normally in a working environment, you're not afraid. But I can assure you that we were afraid. There were different levels of fear. Certainly in the early parts of the hijacking, the fear was at a very high level. And I found myself with many long periods of time for prayer while we were just waiting for things to work themselves out. And I found myself deliberately having to get a hold of myself and handle the fear. I'd look at my hand, it was as steady as a rock, and yet I was just a jello on the inside. And I thought, how can this be? How can I be so shaking on the inside and yet able to handle the situation? So I immediately began thanking the Lord for at least putting on this good show. And then I started praying that I not do something stupid and that we have a maximum survival situation and not turn this thing into some kind of a military mess, which was just on the verge many times. You could know, I suppose, that we were being trailed by the Delta Force from Sicily during this whole episode, and it never became involved, but it became a close thing. And we're very pleased now that the things worked out the way they did. It became important for me personally to very deliberately put my trust and faith in God. Now, that might seem very easy in a normal setting. We all say, well, we trust in God, we have faith in God, we know what he's done for us. But in reality, you sure do want to handle things on your own, I'll guarantee you. It's like, well, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? You know, how should I handle this? And I found myself just saying, okay, Lord, I really don't know what to do. As the situations develop, just give me whatever it takes to handle the situation. Don't let me do anything stupid. Just deal with it step by step as it comes along. And then just kind of grabbing hold of yourself and saying, I will trust. I will have faith. The same God that can deliver me from sin, death, can also deliver me from the devil. Of course, that's what they thought of us, that we were the great Satan over here. But we would get into interesting discussions, some of which, rather than go into detail, I should mention Merv Marquardt over here from CPH tells me that the book that has just been written should be out sometime latter half of October. It's entitled Hostage in a Hostage World, so you might look for that in the future. But it'll go into maybe a little more detail on some of these stories. But the faith had to be deliberate and something that I had to strive for. And as heretical as that might sound on its first wash, it's not when you consider that we have Christ living in us. And he does empower us to do these things and to have faith and to deliberately trust. And I know that that's not me. By myself, I don't have the ability to do that. But as a Christian, I do. And I can say, I will trust. I will just sit and wait. I will work with what the Lord puts in my path. And I will trust that these things will work out for the best no matter what develops. And in fact, that's exactly how things did develop, both with my father's passing, with the way my family had such a unique opportunity to give Christian witness probably to more people than I will ever have the opportunity to do. I work with a group like this, but the television media, while we were over there, was broadcasting a Christian witness that curiously seemed to embarrass them. Maybe I shouldn't, that wasn't so curious. But this whole thing took on a Christian overview, if you noticed, from the very beginning because of the tour group that was on board and the predominant number of Christians that were on board. As a result, the press did have to deal with this in an ongoing way, which I just can only be thankful for, and I can see the Lord's hand in working this out in such a curious way. Eusebius' approach to Christianity is one that I had to remind myself of, that the God of the universe is indeed in charge of what's going on and does work all things for good for those that trust him and are called according to his purpose. And I'd like to think that there was a purpose in all of this. In fact, I definitely know there was. The other thing that strengthened me during this period of time was the one worship service that we held on the airplane was, first we thought we'd pull a Paul and Silas act here, you know, and we would do some singing and get out of this. Then we figured out that we didn't know the words to enough songs to be able to do that, and we couldn't sing that well anyway. And there were just, we thought we could recruit these guys to help us sing, but they didn't know the words either, so that didn't work. So we had our little service, which involved just a some scripture reading and some prayers. And the scripture that we used for a sermon, because neither of us felt like preaching to the other one, was we just read Hebrews chapter 11, 12, and the first part of 13. And boy, that one just hammers away on faith. And it was beautiful. It was just exactly what we needed at the time, I'll tell you. And later in the school courtyard where we were with the others, I used all of that in dealing with the different people that I was able to cross paths with them. When we were working with our Muslim newly developed friends, and we did develop some friendships, it was curious. These were very cautious friendships because we knew where their loyalties and their priorities lay. But at a human level, we were able to deal with them and found them to be surprisingly intelligent. The younger ones were pathetically undereducated because schools had been closed in the Beirut area at least for the last 8 years. And so the only ones that we ran into with educations were the older military people, and they were very sensible and easy to converse with. We found that one-on-one, as we dealt with these people, it was surprisingly easy to relax and just talk to them because you get caught up in the direction of the conversation. And talking to them about Jesus concerning what we know to be true was a much easier thing than I thought. For one thing, they're very respectful people, and they would respect what we had to say. They didn't just dismiss it because they, too, were religious, but off base, that's all. And since they had never heard the Christian message presented in a very logical, sequential, and straightforward, simple way, other than a disinformation way, they were interested from a standpoint of education. We could legitimatize what we were telling them because we were Christian, and we would say, well, what you have been taught concerning Christianity is a lie. We don't know who's teaching you that, but it's not true because this, this, and this is what Christians believe. So the ground was there for laying the gospel out for them to take a look at, and it was easy. It was not difficult in this one-on-one social situation. We found it also important to not insult their intelligence. They were very intelligent people, and they could figure things out for themselves. So as we presented the gospel to them, it was my understanding that the Holy Spirit would work through this, and that I need not handle all of their culturally oriented personal problems, which would have to do with being raised a Muslim and having to be accepted in their communities as cultural Muslims, especially Shahat. So as we discussed things with them, I found, curiously, that they seemed to be willing and able to believe what we told them concerning who Jesus was, where he came from, what he did, and so forth. And I thought, this is interesting. If they can believe this, now they, as they went around and checked with others, and the message was basically substantiated, and they knew that there was no collaboration between us, they were able to distinguish that what we believed was, in fact, different than what they had been taught we believed, and they believed what we told them, and they didn't seem to be all that resistant to the gospel message, which surprised me. Had we gone at evangelizing or mission work from the standpoint of pulling them out of their Muslim beliefs, that would have been a different story. And it seemed to me that the first step in doing mission work or evangelism in this type of a setting would be to very simply give them the gospel, get them through the power of the Holy Spirit to understand and believe what it is that Jesus is all about, and then let them struggle with how they're going to deal with their cultural and religious upbringing. And they will struggle with it, I guarantee you. That way, instead of saying, well, now you must do this and you must do that, as intelligent people, I believe as they study more and more concerning the teachings of Christianity, they themselves can very easily figure out what they must do as they move into Christianity. I don't think that mission work, if viewed as personal evangelism with Christians that are distributed all over the world, I don't think that this type of mission work would be as difficult or as complex as we tend to make it. I think we just need to teach our people that as they travel in their businesses and their jobs and around the world, teach them to deal with their fears and be ready to just be a bold witness, knowing that with Christ in them, who can be against them? And they can just push forth and let the Holy Spirit do the work, but proclaim the gospel. I'd like to at this time see if there's any questions, and as I said, I'd be happy to answer anything. So, yes. Personally, now, the service, well, let me start with the hitting routine. I think that was an attempt to physically gain control of the pilots in the cockpit. They wanted to us and everyone else to know that they were physically in charge of things. It also turned out that that was their way of building up hatred. Now, we've learned to distinguish between the hijackers and the guards. These were the hijackers. And they were very nervous. Evidently, they'd not done something quite like this before. And they were concerned about losing control of the situation. So they were extremely, they overextended themselves in making sure that they were in control. I think the beating was to do that, to establish control, and also to build up the venom, to build up the hatred. And it was a physical way of releasing perhaps some tension on their part. We noticed then as they started beating the passengers that it was somewhat indiscriminate with the intervention of the flight attendants and the purser kind of causing a little backing off to take place until the passports were collected, and some of the military people did not have passports. They were on orders. And so that right away flagged them out as something different, as military. Since then, new State Department directive has it that all military people now travel with passports. But they identified them as military, and so then they became the source of venting hatred on the basis of what the Marines had done, somewhat neglecting why the Marines were there, that they were part of a UN peacekeeping force, that they, in fact, were only shot into areas that were trying to bomb them. You know, they ignored that, but they did have an extreme hatred for Reagan and the New Jersey. And that came off originally, Reagan no good, New Jersey no good, American people are good. And we couldn't figure out what was the matter with New Jersey. That took a long time. We all knew, but we didn't. But for any of you here from New Jersey, we did find out they were speaking of the battleship, and they had nothing against your state. At any rate, they then took to beating on the military people, and they kind of worked around on them, different ones. Statham was the last one, and he was the one that was in position slumped on the floor at the time when one of their demands was not being met. And this was their way of demonstrating to the world that they, in fact, were sincere in their demands and would go to any length. They had been overheard to mention that one American must die, so I think they were just sort of waiting for an opportunity. And curiously enough, the support that they were requesting was from their fellow Shahat, in that the original two hijackers wanted armed militia to give relief to them because they couldn't guard this whole airplane and they were getting tired. They'd been up over 24 hours now, or about 24 hours at that time, and they were on pills, and they wanted assistance. And the assistance available at the airport were the Amal Movement people, and the Amal Movement people didn't want to have anything to do with this. And so it was, it took the killing of Robert Steetham and the threat to kill one more every 5 minutes to get these Shia Muslim Amal Movement people to participate with them. And with that, then they brought some people on board. Next question. Okay, I was the third pilot in the cockpit. My duties were that of flight engineer. And there were three flight crew members, four flight attendants, and one purser. The three of us as pilots had a reunion in Oshkosh this year, which is rather interesting. They hosted us as just brother pilots, I guess, and that was interesting. However, we've not yet gotten together with the cabin crew, and we're going to do that tomorrow in New York. The company board of directors is pulling us all together for the first time since this occurred. So there were a total of eight crew members on board the airplane. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yes. Several very specific things and a number of lesser things. Specifically that, well, for starters, Jesus didn't die on a cross. One of his disciples did, sort of in a martyrdom type of thing that they thought was really great. You know, the idea of martyring yourself for the cause, kind of. And so the way that really shot that down was the group that they hated were not necessarily Jews, but Israeli sympathizers. In fact, Amal was very proud of the fact that they were the defenders of Lebanese Jews. They hated Israeli sympathizers, and generally speaking, that came across as a hatred for anything that had Hebrew writing on it. They would touch all the other money that they could accumulate, but no Hebrew money. They'd leave that on the floor. No Israeli money. Anything that had any Hebrew writing on it, hot potato. They wouldn't touch it. They wouldn't play with it. They made an issue of being disgusted with anything Hebrew. As a result, they would. You must be in a Hebrew class. Right? Now I've forgotten a question. Yeah. Oh, okay. As we were talking of this business about Jesus not dying on a cross and them knowing where his grave was and so forth, or Muhammad did anyway, we pointed out that in those days there certainly would be many graves with the name Jesus on them because that was a relatively common name. On the other hand, this idea of Jesus not dying on a cross, I said, that is historically established. And if someone's telling you that he didn't die on a cross, they are totally ignoring history. Everyone knows that Jesus died on a cross. Even the Jews know that Jesus died on a cross.
Oh.
They weren't going to have something, you know, like be accused of not knowing something that even the Jews knew. But there were other little details, you know. Next question. Yes. Yeah. were not for the press, it wouldn't have been the news that brought the American people together, especially in a Christian context, to where we had so many people coming out of the woodwork. In our community alone, we had Christians speaking out and participating in prayer vigils that that no one knew was a Christian before, you know, and people, men particularly, started talking about their faith and their prayer life. And from conversations I've had with others, this type of thing occurred all over America. And again, we have to thank the press for bringing that phenomena about. There, I'm not quite sure how to deal with all of that, and you can pick it apart if you like, but I see generally a lot more good came out of it than bad. On the other hand, it did advertise a terrorist cause. And so the way that I've been handling that is pointing out that, yes, but this is very negative. When people say, well, do you now have a better understanding of Shia Muslims and their problems in the Middle East? And I'll say, yes, I understand their problems better. However, it is a shame that the world now sees Islam as taught by Shia Muslims as being such a disgraceful thing, such a disgusting thing that they would bring about the death and torture of innocent people, and that they bring disdain down on the Shia Muslim teachings, Islamic teachings, and point out the shame and disdain and disgust and so forth that has been brought down on Shia Muslims. And I believe if whenever we talk of press for terrorists, we are to include that, it would put it would at least assist in putting a negative connotation on the type of press that they do gain. There's also a great deal of discussion that came out of this and the El Salvador thing that's being brought up in the National Defense University now concerning a system for the press. The press themselves want this. It began in Grenada, where they were excluded, and then the El Salvador killing of the people in a restaurant, and now this, and the press is saying, hey, let's work something out. And they are actually coming to the National Defense University and saying, what type of agreement can we come to professionally on how to handle these types of things in the future? So there's groundwork that's being made. And again, had it not been for this situation, maybe the progress in that area wouldn't be as good as it is right now. Yes. I don't know. I'll have to work with that one. There's the... Well, I do know that they are becoming, especially the AMLO, and we saw it in the Hezbollah also, disenchanted with what they are hearing from the voice of Iran, because we ended up conducting a two-week seminar on Christianity and Americanism. Their misinformation on those two issues was so vast that as we corrected it individually, and they could cross-check what we had to say with the other separately held people and found substantiation in these interviews with other people, they began to believe, in fact, that somebody was giving them disinformation concerning how the American people thought and what Christians believed. Those two very specific issues. And so as they became disenchanted with what they were hearing, I have to suspect that they are perhaps paying a little bit more attention to the international press, or at least what Christians have to say. Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, you could make an analogy there. That would be a good one to work on a little bit. Yes. Well, I'll tell you, in the schoolyard, I observed more expressions, very specific and distinct expressions of Christianity that was filmed by, oh, I'll bet there was a dozen different television representatives there. In that schoolyard, there were cameras all over the place. And each time they'd get to talking to somebody, it would come out in lengthy interviews. Now, whatever happened to all that footage, I don't know, but they have managed to to glean what they want, but you know that at least the press corps has been exposed to it, and they don't know what to do with it, but it's there, and I can't hurt anything. Yes, in the back. Okay, they technically are not a Christian army. Maronite Christians, which are neither Orthodox nor Roman Catholic, the Maronite, and we ran into them when some Middle East Airlines people came on board and told us that they were praying for us. And Muslims don't pray for people, evidently, at least as we talked to them and asked them. I don't know what for sure they're supposed to do. I'll have to research that a little bit. But these people said to us, as we asked them, no, they never pray for anybody. Now, they have their obligatory prayers, which they observe, but they don't pray for people. So then when these men said they were praying for us, we knew there was something different here. And then we found out when Maresca went to the hospital, which was the American University Hospital, the surgeon that came on board, who was the airport clinic surgeon, took him to the hospital, and he asked him a few questions, and evidently people, most of the Maronites hold the educated and more white-collar jobs in the area. And they their churches were praying for us. Now, when their army is a pluralistic, supposedly, army, the only problem is it's pluralistic only from the grunt standpoint. You know, all of the foot soldiers are you know, there's a, considering that the predominant population is Shia Muslim in Lebanon, the predominant number of grunts in the army are Shia Muslim. Now, the rub is that 70% of the officers are Maronite Christians. See, so they see an inequity there, and that they are being ignored when it comes to the upper level types of positions. They see that in a cross section. Their government is technically pluralistic. It doesn't work that way, though. Nabi Berri is the cabinet minister in the Lebanese government, but and he's head of the Shia movement ever since Bani Sadr vanished in Algeria, and he's kind of taken over. So now you have this representative there, and he can speak as a representative of the government, but he has no real authority. The authority still rests in Gamal government, which is Maronite Christian. They want representation, and the way it was explained to us, without me being sympathetic to their cause, I'll have to just relay to you the way it was explained to us, is that they feel they are a minority government, just like South Africa. They have representation, but it doesn't have any voice, any vote. They want pluralism, and they want democracy. And this is what the AMO movement people are attempting to do. They are a movement within the Lebanese government to bring about pluralism and democracy. Now, Hezbollah are different. They more strictly follow the voice of Iran, and they desire an Islamic state that knows no borders across the state line. So their struggle is that they know that if they work for an Islamic state, they are a small group, and they have no support around Lebanon, generally speaking. But they then are a better follower of the Ayatollah in Iran. On the other hand, if they want to secure Lebanon, which is a popular issue in Lebanon, then they have to be willing to be pluralistic, which is what Amal says. And the poor Hezbollah folks go back and forth. They don't know if they want to be pluralistic or Lebanese, or if they want to be Islamic. They can't make up their mind. No, I did. I started one in Cascade, Idaho, as a sister congregation to a congregation that I was called as an assistant pastor to. And they desired a mission to be started in a county seat, which is where we moved to. Started the congregation in 1980. And in 1983, I went on CRM status. Things just got busy, and we got a new full-time pastor, and he took on a dual parish, and so that resolved that. Since then, it has continued, just essentially in the same direction. And my ministry has just been a personal ministry, and I've enjoyed it very much. I think it's been productive, and I feel good about it. Just before all of this taking place, my wife, Melda, and I went to a place in Waymo, Switzerland, known as Labrie, and I suppose some of you are familiar with that. And we went there to investigate it. Now, I knew Schaefer came from a Presbyterian background, but I liked that form of ministry and wanted to know how it worked and had read enough about it, but I needed to observe it firsthand. So they very graciously took us on, and we were able to intermingle and observe and essentially had free rein to do what we wanted to there. And I learned a lot, especially that I liked that form of small, dynamic ministry. And with that in mind, when we came back, we started the ball rolling to develop a thing called Labrie on Lake Cascade. And we were just thinking along those lines. We had the support of the folks in Switzerland, and this will not be labeled Lutheran. Of course, neither will it be Reformed. It will be a similar form of ministry tactically, but strategically you might say that it allows a forum open to anyone searching for answers in Christianity along the same lines as they go to Labrie, only the base will come from the same theological base that you are all familiar with as Lutherans here. Yes. They learned I was a Lutheran minister when my father went home and they read of it in a magazine. And that's when I first learned of it. And they expressed a sincere apology and hurt for the situation. They have pretty strong family ties in their country, too. And they recognized that they possibly might have had something to do with it. In fact, he was almost 89 and was ready to go home anyway, so he led a full, rich life, and I have no bad feelings about how that turned out, and I can't really blame them. And with them, it was just one more thing, you know. But I detected a little change in that they hold their mullahs in high esteem and respect, and in fact, contrary to them holding that against me, it seemed to lend credibility to what I did have to say concerning what Christianity taught. And then I think I was sort of the starting point concerning what Christianity teaches, and then they would go around and they'd cross-check with these other folks, and sure enough, you know. And what was the other part of that? No. No, not really. Airline pilots tend to be a lot of things, you know, involved. the one thing that I was happy did not come out was, in fact, that I was involved in the military, because they are so paranoid concerning CIA activities that would have surely been a bad thing. Yes. Yeah, not if you keep the kingdom separate, though. One last question. Yes. Well, certainly Israel has their influence in one direction on them, and Syria has their respect because they provide all the arms. And America has resisted becoming involved with Syria and Lebanon, probably Jordan too to some extent, even though it's not Shia Muslim, but at least Syria and Lebanon, because they are, and this is my personal opinion, okay, I think it's because Israel basically doesn't want us to be involved with those countries in a neutral sort of way. Therefore, they have turned to Russia, And the arms that we observed were primarily of Czechoslovak manufacture under Russian license, Kalashnikov, AK-47s, and things like that. They are very influential. In fact, it was the Syrians that were able to really negotiate this thing and pull it together. Only the Syrians had free access in and out of South Lebanon. We read of the camp wars, for instance. The camp wars were waged by Amal movement people with Syrian assistance to put down these camps, which were Palestinian. And they didn't want the Palestinians bringing Israeli wrath into Lebanon. And so they finally had to put down these camps because they were causing so much of a problem. Not because they loved Israel, but because they didn't like being the guinea pig for what was going on. Well, thank you all very much. I appreciate your support and your prayers, especially during this time when all this is going on. And I would ask that you please keep in mind that fear as a Christian with Christ in your heart, the Holy Spirit working with you, is something that you can conquer. You can deal with it, even when it comes to mentioning the name Jesus in public in a working environment in a non-expletive type of way. It's something that is unfortunate in our Western society that things are the way they are concerning our embarrassment and our being ashamed of the gospel. I think we have to live with that fear. It's part of us. It's just the way Satan works in our body. And with that in mind, when you recognize that the fear is there and it's nothing to be ashamed of because you can be ashamed of it, but you know you're forgiven and you can boldly using the power that's in you, rise above that fear, just trusting in God that he will work things out. God be with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us this morning and sharing both of yourself and your experience, and wish